Don't build the exit, build a dope business, and then someone will want to buy it. I promise you that.
Matt Matros is our guest today. Matt built multiple companies, built Protein Bar and Kitchen, which started Limitless, ended up selling that one to Keurig, Dr. Pepper.
We expect to get 3 times on our money in your investment. We'd like to get 4 times our money on the investment. You get us 5 or more, you're in the Hall of Fame. I remember thinking, man, I want to be in the Hall of Fame.
The way you're talking about it, you would think that this was a total failure, but you had an exit, and it was really not a failure, this company.
That's my therapy Thursday. All 3 of my exits, I think of as failures.
How do you define what that good is?
Because I think about...
Welcome to the Founders Journey Podcast. Inspiration, education for founders by founders. Welcome back to Founders Journey Podcast. Greg Moran, host here with Peter Dean, our co-host. What's up, Peter?
Hey, we're back.
We had a little spring hiatus while I was doing a trip to Europe and India. So really super excited about this one. Guy I've come to know. We met through social media. I would definitely call him a friend now that have gotten to know and have a ton of respect for. Matt Matros is our guest today. Matt built multiple companies. So Matt's not a novice when it comes to being a founder, built Protein Bar and Kitchen, which is a really wildly popular fast casual health food chain. He started Limitless, ended up selling that one to Keurig, Dr. Pepper, which is a nice one, has built a couple other restaurant kind of fast casual brands. Now he's doing something super exciting. So we're going to ask him about that as we go through today, and kind of a roll up he's playing with. Matt and I are kind of collaborating on a couple deals today. One that we just closed my venture fund this week, a company called Route, which is super cool. So Matt, welcome to the podcast. Glad to have you.
This is so flattering. I appreciate the time. And we can tell everyone that we met on the internet on Craigslist misconnections. That's where that still exists, by the way. I'm sure it's
It is. I don't have any example. But it does there is a creepiness factor when you say like, yeah, we met on social media. It definitely has like this little.
It is for you, Greg, because your age.
Not mine. I was gonna say, for our age.
It's not creepy to me, because you know.
Oh, yeah. That's right, because you're so much younger than I am. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So Matt, if you don't follow Matt, just to kind of put a plug in, if you don't follow Matt and you're active on LinkedIn, definitely follow him. He's a super active writer there, prolific writer about his founder experiences. So if you don't follow him, look him up and definitely start to follow him. So let's jump in. Peter.
Yeah. So Matt, why don't we talk about your journey with Protein Bar and Kitchen, and how that started, and kind of walk us through that.
Yeah. And by the way, thank you for those accolades. I'm not really good at talking about myself. I know it's bizarre because I do it once a day on LinkedIn, but I still get a little bit of uncomfortability when I'm spoken about. So forgive me. I guess maybe that's the mental health talking. But Protein Bar was born out of me being a fat kid growing up and being ridiculed as a child for being heavy. It didn't help that my name was Matt, which rhymes with fat. So I heard all the jokes in the book. When I was 21, I was working for a sports agency, and that was when the Atkins diet and low carb really started to take hold. This was in 2000, 2001, and I tried it, and it just worked for me. It was great. It was one of those I swapped out my bread on a bun for no bun and had chicken breasts and steamed vegetables and cut the sugar, and alas, I lose weight. Ended up losing 60 pounds in a summer. And then kept it off for many years, ended up going to graduate school at University of Michigan, then moving to Chicago to work for Kraft. And while I was working at Kraft, there was no place that served the kind of food I wanted to eat. So I took all my life savings. At the time, it was about $200,000. Got some SBA loans. Thank you, Uncle Sam, for another $220 or so. And then ran up my credit cards and opened the first protein bar right across the street from Sears Tower. That was May of 2009. When I opened it, my thesis was going to be healthy protein shakes. I wanted to have a shake shop. So basically a healthier Jamba Juice. Not a lot of people remember the Jamba Juice concept.
Yeah.
So I opened Protein Bar doing mostly shakes, almost entirely shakes. And we were doing about $2,000 a day in sales and not making it. Needed to be doing about three to break even. So I added food to the menu, and that's when things just took off. Ended up raising money from folks that I met in the restaurant while I'm making burritos and shakes. People would say, wow, this place is awesome. Is this a franchise? I'm like, nah, man, it's just me. So I got to know a lot of loop traders, bankers, and attorneys and the like, and ended up raising money from one, and then two, and three, and four, and just opened units across the country. Opened about 30 units in a four-year span, so pretty precipitous growth, and then sold a majority of the business to L. Catterton, which is the preeminent private equity firm in the world focusing on consumer brands. They bought 60% of the company, and I went from being fully in control to now working for a private equity firm. So that was the story of Protein Bar. I stayed on for, just to put a bow on it, sorry, I stayed on for about a year and ran it as the CEO. And then the business outgrew me. I like to say that it outkicked my coverage. And we ended up hiring a CEO to replace me. And then I took some time off. So I got fired. I got fired by Karen.
So walk us through, Matt, the story of that exit and kind of the dynamic, right? That you exited, you're now running the business for a year. Walk us through that story.
Gosh, so this was 2012, which, gosh, it really was a long time, a lifetime ago. Protein Bar, as it related to consumer brands and restaurant and retail, we were like the hot girl at the dance. Like everybody wanted to dance with us because I had proven portability. So I worked in Chicago. I opened in Washington, D.C. was our biggest opening to date. So it wasn't just a Chicago thing. Mm-hmm. It was healthy food. Everyone was getting into healthy. So two things were hot, specialty retail and healthy food. And we were both, you know, Noodles and Company just went public. Container Store was about to go public. So we were hot. So we had a lot of inbound interest. And for me, I knew I needed to put some gas on the fire. So I knew I needed to raise big dollars from just a sheer amount of money. Up till then, I had raised about $10 million, all friends and family, which is a substantial amount of money. But I needed, you know, I just really wanted to kind of put that foot on the gas. So I was lucky in that I was interviewing a variety of private equity firms, all the best names in the space, and didn't hire an investment banker until the very end. And it was L. Catterton that I got the most comfortable with and wanted to do a deal with. So I like to say that not only did I marry the girl that I wanted to marry, but it just so happened she had the richest dad. So it was not only the firm I wanted to go with, but they ended up giving us the best offer from a private equity firm. They bought a majority stake, so they ended up buying 60% of the business for $25 million. So you can do the math on that. A good amount of it went to the balance sheet, but then a good amount of it went in the form of a secondary offering. So me and all of our shareholders got to take some cash out. And then on October 1st, I toasted my Justin Isosceles Cabernet at Chicago Cut Steakhouse to celebrate the deal and had a boss and had an underwriting plan that I had to go versus a vision I had to go source. And they're the best in the game. This isn't about them. It was really more about me going from being a rogue entrepreneur, doing whatever I wanted, and fortunately having success, right? I mean, that was the linchpin in the whole thing is that we were opening stores that were successful. If we weren't, it wouldn't have mattered. But, and then now all of a sudden having a boss. I got paid for it. So I took some cash out. I often think that I wish that I had sold 90% of the business instead of 60. But here we are. So that was the deal. So I got fortunate in that I was able to, I did what I wanted to do, which was raise money from a preeminent private equity firm. It just, unfortunately for us and for them, didn't work out.
So you've exited a few times, right? I mean, you had that one, you've had Limitless, you've had others along the way. How did they vary from each other?
So Protein Bar, I mean, there's lots of ways they structurally varied, but ultimately, with Protein Bar,
more on the personal side for you, man.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The real thing that I try to instill in founders is that an exit really should be thought of as a full control that you're handing over to someone else. That's how I define an exit, meaning someone else is responsible for this thing. Mm-hmm. In the instance of Protein Bar, I gave up a majority stake of the business. So now someone else was an owner. And then legally speaking, they had controls, right? That's what governance and boards is. With Limitless, I sold an asset, which was a literal trademark that I sold to Keurig Dr. Pepper. So it was theirs, 100% theirs. And they incentivized me with a sort of an earnout. And then with ShopFlix, it was less of a brand that was being sold and more around me and my capabilities. So I call that an acqui-hire. Because they didn't really acquire the brand or the assets. They really acquired me, which sounds pretty arrogant when I say it like that. But that's essentially what this
is. It's true. People do it all the time. It's pretty normal.
Yeah, absolutely.
But ultimately speaking, it was – so the pros or the similarities were giving up control, right?
Yeah.
Protein Bar, Limitless, ShopFlix gave up control. It's not the Matt show anymore. The difference is, I mean, economically speaking, mass, very big difference in each of them, you know, sort of what came to me, what I was rolling. So going back to what an exit is, it's again, me giving up control or the founder really giving up control. So in Protein Bar's instance, I gave up control and got paid for it. So they bought equity in the business. With Limitless, I gave up control and me and my investors got paid for it. They bought an asset. With ShopFlix, I gave up control and then went to go work for QVC as part of it and then got upside down. So I guess it really was about me working for someone else. So I'm really good at that 0 to 1.
That's really interesting you said that. Greg, you've done this before. Did it feel like that for you? Like you were then working for someone else, or did it take time to transition into that?
My journey was actually very similar to, you know, yours, Matt, with Protein Bar, right? I mean, I stayed on. I sold to really large private equity. These guys know what they're doing. They're an incredible operator. And I stayed for about 18 months. There was this period right when you closed the deal where you kind of just, you're sort of rushing into this new relationship and you're married, but you didn't really date for more than a couple months. So you're just trying to figure out like who you're actually married to and everybody's getting along and it's wonderful. There's almost, I mean, it's clear, it's definitely a honeymoon period before you remember like you are truly working for somebody. And these guys make money for a reason. They know how to operate these businesses. And very, very, very few founders have either the interest nor the ability to go do that, right? Because it's a wildly different thing. It's just everything about it is totally different than the day before, right? When you're the founder, you're in control, and now you're running a large company.
I think I've distilled it down to when you're a founder, you have a vision. And when you have a private equity firm or someone else that owns a business, you have an underwriting plan.
It is an underwriting plan. That's a very distinct difference.
My vision, right? I want to go build a bunch of stores. I want to go, each store is going to operate at 22% EBITDA margin. Da, 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 da. But Counterton has a spreadsheet. It's an underwriting. So it's not their fault or my fault. It's just maybe that's the title of the book that I write one day.
I love that you're saying that because I don't think we've ever actually used that term underwriting plan on the podcast. But I lived that world just like you did, right? Where everything came back to, well, here's what the underwriting plan said, right? You're going from the strategic, the big vision to something that's extremely tactical. And it's a project plan, right? Yeah. It's just a 3 to 5 year project plan. And it's a jump that the brain of the founder is always going to gravitate toward that big, right? I'm going to go do huge things. And if all stuff gets like screwed up along the way, that's okay. I'll figure that out later. Where the PE is like, screw you, you're going to figure that out later, right?
Yeah. Matt talked about a little bit your reason. It kind of led into why you started the company. And that is a very personal thing. There was a personal reason that you felt like you could give back to this community in a way that's meaningful. And then when you say it that way and you say there's an underwriting plan, that's a contrast. Like, how did it make you feel? Like, what were the things you went through when you realized that? Like, what was that like? Because this is really important for founders to know. Like, I don't think I know a founder that made it to the 2-year earnout. I actually know one that was it. And they just were like left alone to kind of do their own thing. But when they had an underwriting plan, I don't know one that's ever kind of made it out the length that they're supposed to.
It was like, I felt like, and I feel bad for Catterton a little bit. And sometimes I joke, I'm like, it was 51% my fault, 49% theirs. Or some days it's 51% their fault, 49% mine.
Yeah.
But after they invested, it literally was Murphy's Law of things that could go wrong, went wrong. So they put money in October. In January, that was January of 2014, we had in Chicago what is now known as Siberia, where the entire city shut down for 2 weeks because it was so cold. Now, when we think of it in the world of climate change, it doesn't seem that unusual. But in 2014, like, it was shocking that it was so cold. People physically weren't going to work. And again, this is all pre-COVID. So the idea of working from home was different. So that happened. And then we opened a store in Boulder, Colorado. It was my first store in Colorado. And we opened on April 2nd of 2014. And the city of Boulder has never had snow in April. Or some statistic like that, right?
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second. I am sitting about 20 minutes from Boulder, Colorado right now, and I got 5 feet of snow the other day.
So. Well, never was.
This was a kind of an anomaly.
Right, yeah, exactly.
This particular week in April, and actually it's like literally to the day we're recording that, it hadn't snowed in Boulder in maybe 50 years on whatever that first week of timing.
Yeah. Right.
Some statistic like that. Well, the day we opened, it snowed. And it was a huge blizzard, and a huge snowstorm. And so all these little things, just sort of added up. Or we had a location that I was going to open and we had everything ready to go, but the architect forgot to sign something on the permit application and it sat for 8 weeks. Like all these just little things that we were humming on all cylinders and then the deal closed and it just seemed like we weren't. So all those things started to kind of add up. And again, when it's just me doing whatever, you just sort of adjust and you take a hit and you get back up and go with it.
Yeah.
But think about the spreadsheet that those guys had in Greenwich, Connecticut. And
sell for that, man.
No, right. They didn't have that. That wasn't there.
But somewhere there was like a temperature algorithm on Boulder, Colorado, and it just,
right.
It just flowed to everything. So everything just kind of went bad.
Let's just say I've had some similar experiences, right? Why does inevitably the shit just totally hit the fan after these deals? It's like the moment the founder walks out the door, because you see this all the time, right, Matt? And I know, and I've got a bunch of friends, I know, my guess is you do too, who have sold to private equity, watch the businesses just absolutely tank. Ended up buying the companies back, built them back, sold it again, tanked, they got tanked again. Why does it happen?
It's normal. It's a regular thing. It legit is regular.
Right. I mean, what's your take? Why do you see it over and over again?
In a full disclosure, I've made several offers to buy Protein Bar back as recently as a month ago. What the investors would tell you, and this, the same thing happens with big companies too, trying to do innovation. A lot of these guys just don't do small very well. I mean, Dr. Pepper said that to me about Limitless. We just don't do small well. And Limitless, we bought when you were pretty small. I mean, huge for me, huge for my investors, but small for them. Perhaps the same with Catterton. They are really good at investing in Cheddars and Noodles and Company and massive restaurant chains. But when they started doing something a little bit more earlier emerging, they realized that maybe it's not the same playbook. And I think maybe it all just comes back to they're investors, not operators. And I think I waited too much on their own expertise or something that I thought I was going to get from them from a playbook perspective. When at the end of the day, no one's ever started a protein bar before.
Right.
They have grown and built billions of dollars worth of restaurant chains, but they've never done mine.
Right.
I guess my point is I maybe underestimated my own kind of I got us here type thing and maybe to outsource some of my own vision and thinking to others. And again, this isn't a bash. I know it might sound like it's a bash on them.
No, I don't think it is.
It was more of an oil and water, two things that are great, but just not great together.
Yeah. And sometimes it does work. It has worked before, but
sure, of course.
To your point, I've seen it. We get called in a lot as an agency to show up and try to fix some of these problems. And it's like, what just happened? Like, it's totally changed. And then it kind of comes to a halt, it feels like. And then they have to kind of get going again. A lot of it, it's people, right? It's people, personalities, and people believing in certain people. And you can't replicate that with process or
it's harder
a spreadsheet, or like you said. Or
the other part of it too is that we all forget that these private equity guys, they're professional investors, and VC guys are professional investors, but they're not right every time.
No.
In fact, the best venture investor is only right 1 out of 20. And that dude's like in the Venture Capital Hall of Fame, right? Mm-hmm. 1 out of 20. So you tend not to hear the stories about the 19 failures, but they happen, right? And in Catterton's instance, not every one of their investments is dope.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, don't go so great, right? And I just so happen to be the unfortunate benefactor of one of them.
That they couldn't grow. It didn't mean you couldn't, because you got it to that point. Like, it meant.
But this is this is the therapy I deal with, right? Every single day. And I deal with this with Limitless and Dr. Pepper. Because when I gave Limitless to Dr. Pepper, it was in every Walmart nationwide and a bunch of CVSs, and now not as much. But still, I feel a responsibility, or I feel something was flawed in me or was wrong in me, that it didn't get to be 1,000 stores like the underwriting plan said. Like, something had to be wrong with me, right? Like, I know I sold it, but like, something has to be wrong because I'm one of the ingredients.
Believe me, man. Like, I've struggled with this exact same thing and with some previous exits, very similar kind of trajectories. And there's two things. Peter said a bunch of P's. And there was one actually I was hoping you were going to say, right? Which was passion. And there's two things I think that I've just seen play out so many times in these kind of deals, right? Number one, it's this playbook mentality of, we know the answer, we're going to run this play, and this is going to be the outcome, as if this stuff is predictable. And it's not, and it never is, right? Yeah. And the other one, it's the passion. It's that what I think private equity gets wrong over and over and over and over again is it tries to become prescriptive with this underwriting model. And these are the things that we're going to do. But the heart, the soul sits with that founder.
Yeah.
Right? So you extract that soul and now you're running a business as a spreadsheet. And it's not, but that's the part. It's so intangible and it doesn't fit with that investor mindset. But the founder knows exactly what the hell it means, right? The founder understands the value of that completely, but the investor they don't get it, right? And I think that's, to me, that's the ingredient. I've lived this a couple times, and that's that thing that occurs where you're just like, holy crap, man, do you not see? Nobody gives a shit about your underwriting model.
Right.
But they do give a shit about this company.
Because they try to take what Matt did and like go, oh, what did he do that was unique? Well, what actually was unique was that. And it's not really what he did. It's how he did it, right? It's like why he did it.
We're talking about Matt like he's not here.
I'm smiling a little bit because I'll never forget the day I'm sitting in Colorado. It was in Broomfield. We were at a Starbucks. It was me and the partner from Catterton and the young guy who became the lead. And we're looking at the underwriting plan. And this is before the deal closed. This is when we're still negotiating the terms of the deal. And I'm thinking to myself, holy shit, they're pricing this to fucking perfection. Like I have no margin for error here. But I wasn't about to say that because the valuation and all the everything was built based on me being perfect. So I'm not going to tell them, hey guys, I'm really going to be wrong like 3 out of 10. They priced it as if I was right 10 out of 10. And I was I enjoyed the fruits of that underwriting.
Sure.
But I remember sitting there in that Starbucks in Broomfield, Colorado, like, damn, I can't mess up. But that I knew I was going to, because I knew that the store model that they put for the average was like my best effort. And I'm like, that's what they're putting as their average.
Yeah. Sometimes they think, oh, we can help you get better. Yeah. When reality, I've heard you say it before and other things. you said you're using someone else's system. This isn't a new thing you built, like how to open stores, right? It's been done before, right? But you, what you're doing is not really opening stores. It's your brand and what you're doing with it.
But here we are. And those guys are rich and private equity works. It's yep. just, we just don't forget that it's, you know, you got to be in private equity. I remember Catterton guys, I was in their office one day and they toured me around. And by the way, I fucking love Catterton. Scott Dankey, Michael Chu, brilliant. John Owsley was my partner. They're literally the best in the business. Mm-hmm. I just happened to be an investment that didn't work for them. So it's not that they suck. It's, and again, as we're talking here, it's probably me. But I remember walking around their office and they had this whole room that had a bunch of trophies and memorabilia and just stuff in it. I was like, what is that? And they're like, that's the Hall of Fame. Oh, tell me more. He's like, well, we expect to get 3 times on our money in your investment. We'd like to get 4 times our money on the investment. You get us 5 or more, you're in the Hall of Fame. I remember thinking, man, I want to be in the Hall of Fame. So they work, right? They make investments mm-hmm. that return money. That's why their private equities are billionaires. But we all forget that in order to get those Hall of Fame returns, they got to have some stinkers, or they got to hit some singles, or they got to get hit by a pitch.
They got to learn.
They got to take a mm-hmm. hit. And sometimes those stories just aren't told.
That's right.
Maybe I'm the martyr.
It's funny because the way you're talking about it, you would think that this was a total failure, but you had an exit and it was really not a failure, this company.
That's my therapy Thursday. All 3 of my exits, I think of as failures.
Yeah. See, another entrepreneur is going to go, what are you talking about? Like, so how do you define what that good is?
Because I think about that day, October 1st, when we toasted my Justin Isosceles at the closing dinner. And when I rolled 40% of equity, I rolled equity because I thought, and I was looking yeah. forward to the future. And I think of myself as a failure because we didn't achieve that. I let Catterton
the next stage, right?
Yeah. I didn't get Catterton their 3 times on their money. Something must be wrong with me. Dr. Pepper and Limitless. That's the drink isn't everywhere. Pepsi copied it with bubbly bounce. And, you know, that's what I'm saying. Something has to be wrong with me or something that I did. It just has to be. I'm serious, but this is what I deal with, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
And it's only recently that maybe it's because I'm getting older or I have a son now, so my perspective has changed, or maybe it's psychedelic drugs. I don't know what it is, that I'm actually starting to zoom out a little bit and think about my life as a stock chart. And if I'm zooming in on the little blips that was the Catterton experience or Dr. Pepper, then yeah, maybe it's a failure in my own head. But zooming out kind of in the grand scheme or in the grand picture, and then also thinking about where it fits for me and my, God willing, 90 years on the planet. And it's just a part of the journey, right? Founder's journey, like the
famous
podcast, right? So. But yes, it sucks. That's why I'm heavily medicated, guys.
I want to get into the mental health aspect of this because I think it's a really important one. But Peter's going to go there in 1 second. But you're absolutely right. The reason we named this podcast "The Founder's Journey" is because these kind of stories that you're telling right now, this is what it really looks like, you know. And when somebody starts to move along this path of a true founder over a trajectory, right? Like a multi-time founder and stuff, this stuff is not clean, right? These stories are never clean stories. No. And, you know, you get through these things and it's like, wow, that was fucked up, man. Like that was so, I don't even know how we got to I don't even know what the fuck just happened. You know, I think I'm a little bit older than you, Matt. And I think it's one of those things that I think for me has turned from, because I beat the hell out of myself for watching some businesses really tumble after I left. And I think now it sort of turned into this, man, that ride was really friggin' fun. And I don't know what happens next, but man, like there was 14 years of my life that I would never trade. That's the part that I think when you, the more you kind of step back and the more you sort of look at that broader perspective, it's like, look, that disconnect that has to occur between the founder and the company is brutal. But once you can kind of put that line in there to say, this is not mine, this is something that somebody else needs to now deal with. But my time was totally different. My time, you know, when I was building this thing was totally different. You don't want to be that guy saying, oh, here's the 10 things you're doing wrong. But you can still take, you know, you can still find the joy in like what really occurred there. And
yeah.
Because you almost have to have this like cognitive dissonance, right? Because you look at it and it's like, man, holy crap, dude. Like what what the hell are you doing? Right. But you get that, you know, I don't know. That's the way that I've kind of tried to build that barrier.
I try to remind myself that maybe there's a little bit of the spotlight effect, which if you're familiar with the spotlight effect, it's that we tend to think that people care a lot about how we look and what we're doing. And, you know, I thought of this when you were talking about, you know, it's our company, now it's someone else's. But in reality, October 1st was just another day for Protein Bar. For the 10,000 customers we served that day and for the 600 employees. And it was just another day. Right. But for us, it was this thing. And we tend to feel like we are in the spotlight, perhaps at least. I don't know. Maybe the luxury of time and hindsight is what changes. And psychedelic drugs, I suppose.
Yeah. So the mental health issues is real. Like I see a therapist, you know, it took me a while to kind of get to that point. But like our journey as a founder is unique. Unless you have friends like Greg or you to talk about it, you can kind of be on an island. And that's one of the reasons we started this podcast, to kind of share this stuff. So people feel like, hey, this is real. This has happened to me. I should, you know, I can reach out to another founder and talk about it. Can you talk about kind of your, you know, you started talking about that, like what you're doing and what you experienced?
I do say that you are on an island. You are lonely, heavy as the head that wears the crown, insert all those things. There are some baked in things in society that help you cope with that, whether it's literal social media, friends, relationship, whatnot. And then there's other things that are manufactured, like professional groups like YPO. I was a member of that for a while.
Yeah.
Ultimately speaking, I found that being around other folks that most closely resemble me, I'll talk about that in a second, but most closely resemble me is the most important. Now, doesn't mean that they're just entrepreneurs. So I've been around a bunch of rooms or a lot of rooms with just entrepreneurs, but they have to resemble me. They have to have a chip on their shoulder because they lost their dad when they were young, or because they were, you know, bullied as the fat kid. So they have to have some of that level of adversity that you kind of connect with. They can't just be a founder.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Cause they're not, that's true. I get you there. Yeah.
So I found my best relationships, deepest relationships and best friendship is when I realized, I am on an island, but fortunately I'm in a pocket of islands, an isthmus, if you will, where there's a lot of little islands around there. We're all going through the same weather together. You know, my unique island is, there is nobody else. There's no other protein bar island. There's no other.
Right.
Island. There's an island next door that's getting the same weather, but
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend,
the island next door is getting the same weather. That's a really good way to talk about it.
But it is hard. But the other part of it too, that I'm a little bit nervous about, is that I fear that LinkedIn may be a little bit of the canary in the coal mine from a founder depression and mental health disorder, in the same way that Instagram and early social media was for teenage girls in 2012. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little about that. And that's part of why I sort of have decided to commit to being open about this topic, is because I don't want founders to think that everybody is Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Or Bill Gates. They're not. Like, that is the vast, 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 vast exception to the rule, you know, times a million. But we all think that that could be the case. Just as a teenage girl may think that every supermodel is what femininity should look like.
Right.
Because that's not what entrepreneurship is. Business ownership is much different than that. So I'm hoping to shine a light on that in some way. Now, sometimes I worry maybe I'm part of the problem, you know, because I'm using social media as the tool to promote that message. I don't really know how else to kind of help it, but I just want people to kind of know the truth. You know, even a dude with three exits takes 40 milligrams of Prozac every day, you know, mm-hmm. and like, I'm very lucky. I love my wife. She's the best. I have the best son, but I have body image issues and self-esteem issues and, you know, comparison issues. And I deal with it with my basket of coaches and sobriety and whatever else I can just to try to get through every day.
What do you tell founders? What do you tell, you know, CEOs, founders that are trying to build their companies that are experiencing this thing, but probably aren't.
Or even dealing with it.
I'm a bad person to talk to founders who I can tell are in it for the wrong reasons. So sometimes recently I was with a founder who I could tell started a business just because he wanted to start a business. So he basically found a solution that was looking for a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I can tell pretty early when someone not necessarily has the chops for entrepreneurship. Because I don't know that anyone really has the chops per se. It's either born, not born, innate, learned, who knows? Like there's every different model for it. But whether they're solving a real problem or just telling themselves, like in an almost a delusional sort of a way that they're solving a real problem, like I can snuff that out pretty fast. And it doesn't go well for me or them from a feedback perspective. And I don't like myself oftentimes when I have to push and give what I describe to these founders tough love, because I'm just some asshole, right? Who am I to tell this founder whether or not he or she will have a successful business? But usually it's easy to see if people don't solve a real problem and they just don't have that fire inside them to solve that problem.
Yeah, it's not about making money.
I struggled with these kind of issues, the over the rails anxiety, bordering on real depression issues and things like that through a lot of the later years of that journey, right? With Outmatch, my previous company. But I never told anybody about it. My wife knew because she could see it, right? She was experiencing it, you know, living with somebody dealing with that is not super awesome. It wasn't until we sold where the complete just breakdown occurred, right? Mm-hmm. And because I actually like came up for air for a second. It was like, oh my God, like this is crazy. But the thing is, it's so common, right? Like, what do you tell that person that you know they're struggling with it, you know, but they're not opening up, or if they're listening to this, what do you do when you're in that spot and you're just trying to battle through it because you're weak or you can't, like you can't, you won't let go. Your perception is
I still
weak,
have
right?
to do this. I got to yeah. keep going. Cause
I call that right. sort of the fog of war. I try to tell yeah. those founders who are in those situations that there's a difference between being resilient and fighting because you have grit and you believe in something and just being delusional or just, right. was dreaming up a scenario that you think exists for your business and telling yourself that it's achievable just because you dreamt it up. Point being is that like how I'm saying this is sort of harsh or strong. So usually I'll try to disarm them by just letting them know it's okay to be to fail.
Yeah.
It's okay mm-hmm. that it didn't work. It's okay to pivot, right? It's okay to your original idea was to sell protein shakes. It didn't work. Sell food. Your original idea to sell coffee. It didn't work. Sell sparkling water. It's just okay. It doesn't always work. And oftentimes the other part of it too is recognizing that there's so many things outside of, and maybe I should be drinking my own Kool-Aid on this one, but like, there's so many things outside of our control that affect whether or not we'll be successful.
Yeah.
Right.
Tons.
Timing, competition, other things happening in the market, COVID, like there's just so many things that there's outside of your control that have, and in the instance of Protein Bar, we got dinged because right after I sold is when sort of like all the meal delivery kit things started becoming popular.
Yeah.
And although those weren't restaurants, they were certainly taking share yeah. of economic. So it's like, I couldn't control that. No one knew that Uber yeah. Eats was going to exist. They just didn't, you know? So yeah. like, so just recognizing that there's a lot of things that, and again, I need to take my own advice here, but just recognizing there's a lot of things that are outside of your control that affect the outcome. or that will impact the outcome outside of your very actions. I'm like, go tattoo that on my butt or something. So I can
and that's,
remember that. I got to remember that myself.
Absolutely. And it's just part of it. Right. I mean, that's the thing. That's why it's a journey, right? You just don't know what's going to be around that corner that, you know, is going to come, you know, hit you in the.
And everything I'll say is because of social media, and maybe this is the difference, right? Being an entrepreneur now in 2024 versus, you know, 1984, is that we have the unfair ability to compare ourselves to others. Mm-hmm. And that works against us, right? And I say to people, just because you see someone doing it doesn't mean they're doing it well. Someone will say, oh, this brand is killing it. I'm like, really? Do you look at their P&L? Do you have their sales statements? No, but they're everywhere. Their trade show booth's so big, or they're all over Instagram. That just means they buy a bunch of Instagram ads. That doesn't mean they're successful.
Right.
You know, having your own measuring stick for what success is. And to me, in business, there's only one measure of success. It's dollars profit, right? You can have revenue, but you can have dollars profit. If you have revenue, at least you're in the game. But dollars profit is kind of the only one that sort of matters. You don't have that, then tell yourself whatever you want.
Yeah. No, it's totally true. So we've got a last question here, Matt, before we wrap up. I mean,
Lionel Richie. I can go all night long, man.
We can do this interview all night long too. I mean, there's just so much that you're saying that is, it's so relevant to, I think, a lot of the people who are listening to this, and the way you approach it, I think is just so, it's so fantastic. And just how open you are about these challenges and how vulnerable you are about these challenges is really amazing. It's just it's a huge service to an awful lot of people. Just think about, you know, if you think about the kind of step back for a second, right? What are the big three pieces of advice you would give a founder just getting going today that, you know, is trying to build a growth company and maybe look for that PE or, you know, big strategic exit? What are the three pieces of advice you'd give them?
Nothing matters but getting the first dollar of sales. Dream about it all you want, plan the exit. But I've seen so many wannabe and aspiring founders that have like planned themselves out of doing something. Just get the first dollar of sales.
Yep.
And then with that dollar, hopefully you can turn it into a penny of profit. But get the first dollar. So sort of like the whole just do it. Mm-hmm. The second one is, as it relates specifically to exit, is don't build the exit. Build a dope business, and then someone will want to buy it. I promise you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so if you're now, obviously you can't be so novel of an idea that there isn't a universe of acquirers. But if you're generating revenue and dollars profit, someone will want to buy that one day. And then I guess sort of kind of like putting a bow on both of those comments is just knowing that, you know, perfection is the enemy of progress.
Yeah.
And I suffered from this. Protein bars, very expensive stores. These are very expensive cans to produce. So you had to get the logos and everything just right. Well, in today's world, you can lo-fi and prototype things. You can have an idea that's literally just a $26 landing page on card.com and test to see if people do it by Facebook ads and have an idea tested in an hour and $100. Like, that's great. So try that. Dude, go put up a landing page for selling whiz-bang widgets and see if anybody wants to buy whiz-bang widgets. And when they click add to cart, say like, just kidding, or like, coming soon. It costs you nothing.
Yeah.
And see if there's an interest in there instead of daydreaming. The other part of it too, I have so many founders who say, oh man, I could just see this thing everywhere. And I say, that's the supply side of the equation. What about the demand side? Where are the consumers saying, I really want to, because I can see my poop everywhere. But if no one wants to buy my poop, it doesn't matter. Like, so many entrepreneurs, oh man, this would just be so great in gyms or health clubs, or I could see this everywhere. We sold to schools. Really? Show me a school that wants to buy it.
Yeah, exactly.
Gosh, it's not like such a Debbie Downer on this call. Maybe we should.
No, man. This is
perfect.
This is real. And look, this is why this is exactly why we started this, right? Because what we wanted to do was tell the stories of people that were actually right, that were living this. Like, okay, yeah, we've heard the Zuckerberg story, we've heard the Bezos story, we know, like, rocket ships. Now they're competing. Yeah, but
did we ever ask them how hard it was or what shit they went through? You know, like,
right?
They still got somewhere, but it still doesn't mean they're happy. Like, we don't know about them. Like, we really don't. Do we really know them or what their brand wants us to know about them? Right.
Because and I think, and Matt, it's because there is so, and you said this when we started, there is so much glorification now of the entrepreneurial lifestyle. Like, I mean, it's, you see it all the time, but it's really hard. Right. And it doesn't mean it's not something to go do and try and go pursue it, but just know it is really, really hard. And you know what? And you said this right as we started, for probably 95% of the population, keep your job.
Yeah. Way
you're
better.
Probably going to be,
I kind of wish probably I did gonna, a long time ago.
Here, you're probably going to be happier, right? You're probably going to lead a more peaceful, content life. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Or you can just enjoy the fact that this journey, that you don't know what the outcome is going to be, and you don't know if you're going to get a dollar tomorrow, and you just have faith in yourself and you say, okay, I'm going to go down this path. I'm going to find out where it goes. It's not what I think it, you know, it may be something I have no clue where it's going to lead me, and just let it take you there by trying to innovate or do something new or just be yourself, like, in trying to find a way. And that's where, when you get to an exit, the what did you call it? It was like the spreadsheet, but you call it
the underwriting model.
Oh, the underwriting. An underwriting plan has nothing to do with that journey, right? My three companies and your three companies, you'd be like, no, I'm super successful, and I'll tell you my story someday so you can feel better about yourself. But you just got to enjoy the journey. And that's what Greg and I have been talking about. And that's what you're talking about now, is being real with yourself, with what that journey is. You know, and you employed people. You did so many things. It's amazing. You know,
I'm not done yet, right? Back half of my life here. So
yeah, exactly. It's not over.
Yeah, man. You got to. Before we wrap up, talk about what you're doing now. You know, I want to get into how people can connect with you and reach you and stuff. But talk about what you're up to now, because it's a super cool concept. And again, you and I just invested in one of the companies that you connected me with, and, you know, tell the story, because I think it's an awesome one.
Yeah, I'm backing owner operators of janitorial companies. So literal small businesses. You know, what I'm going to say might make me sound like I'm Gordon Gekko here, but certainly not. Like, it's, I'm buying and investing in small, you know, in some instances under $1 million in sales, but these owner operators of commercial cleaning businesses don't have access to capital that allows them to grow. And it's usually because they don't really have investable businesses in a traditional sense, or because their access to capital is limited to credit cards or factoring.
Yeah.
So I'm helping commercial cleaning owners by giving them a little bit of capital, taking some things off their plate, like bookkeeping and scheduling and all the boring stuff, so that they can go do what they do best as cleaning company owners, which is usually selling customers or cultivating and training employees, sometimes both. So I have this collection of janitorial companies across the country that I'm backing the founders, and then hopefully helping them build to an exit to a private equity in a sort of like a roll-up kind of a way.
Yeah.
And I'm taking an equity position in their businesses, where usually I'm having to explain to these people, like, God bless them, like, Alejandro's like, wait, you mean you're going to give me $100,000 and I don't have to pay you back? Like, explaining to them the difference between equity and what?
It's not like I'm sending you on vacation, but
Right. You know what I say is, I'm not doing it because I'm a swell guy. I'm not like so benevolent that, like, I'm doing it because I'm investing in you and I want to get a return on that $100K. Because I think if that $100K, if we do this underwriting plan, right? Actually, we don't have an underwriting plan. We just have
to just circle the right around.
We actually don't have an underwriting. Maybe part of my problem. Maybe I should have more underwriting. But I'm investing in these folks that typically are uninvestable because they're not traditional assets.
Yeah, now you're helping them out in a real way.
And I appreciate that it's like help, but it's also hopefully going to work from a return perspective.
Yeah.
I hope so, because my life savings.
I mean, if you give an exit to a company like that, that's a big deal.
Correct.
How would someone get there?
These are micro-sized transactions. We're talking about turning $1 million janitorial company into a $6, $7, or $8 million company, such that they can then sell to a private equity.
Yeah. Because otherwise, it'd be really hard to sell that in the market on their own. You know,
they don't know where to go.
They're too small. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I love it, man. I love those kind of, you know, super niche consortium businesses like that, that are, you know, where you have founders that have, they've got the grit, they've got the determination, they have every single thing they need.
Yeah.
They just need a little support to kind of get, you know, to really build these things into something that is transactable at a later stage. And the business that, that you had connected me with is the piece of software that's kind of connecting a lot of these businesses, a company called Route. We'll get Ricardo on here.
Yeah, Ricardo's an example of a founder. He's an example of a founder who has grit. He solved a real problem for himself and then has recognized that there are other founders. So the problem that he's solving is that in commercial janitorial, it's really hard to bid jobs, as dumb as it sounds, right? Not all houses are the same. Not all factories are the same. Not all offices are the same. So it's really hard to bid the job. Well, the bid is important because if you bid wrong, you lose money.
Yep.
So Ricardo founded Route as a software program from his own personal family janitorial business to build it. And it's an awesome piece of software. We're going to install it at a lot of our companies and we'll see. I have no idea if my investing thesis in small commercial cleaning companies is going to work. I have no clue. I may lose my shirt. But there's something about these founders. They just need some help, both financially and some support. And there is a path to an exit. So we talked about earlier how to plan for an exit. In this instance, I have no idea what the exits look like, but I do know that janitorial companies are a category of businesses that are frequently sold to private equity. So it's not like I'm making that up. That's the plan. We'll see.
Love it, man. Well,
that's cool.
Matt, incredible having you on. Like I said, the candor, the vulnerability, I love it. It's been amazing continuing to get to know you and, you know, not only, you know, like I said before, if you're not following Matt on LinkedIn, definitely do it. What you heard today is a lot of what he talks about. And I think there's not a founder out there who's not going to benefit from, from reading his story. So amazing, amazing experience, regardless of how you are viewing this. So, you know, at this point,
exactly.
It's extraordinary what you've accomplished and we're proud to have you on here. So, So that's it for this edition of the Founders Journey podcast. If you liked it, like it, you know, on wherever you're listening to this, and preferably leave a comment and give us a review and share it, because this is our startup and we need all the help we can get too. So spread the word. See you next time on the Founders Journey podcast.
Thank you guys. This is great.